You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and this is KCRW's Bookworm, our weekly book show. Today I have with me in the studio David Levitt, whose new novel, Equal Affections, just came out this month from Weidenfeld and Nicholson, a relatively new publisher. It's his first book with that publisher. His earlier books were Family Dancing and The Lost Language of Cranes. David, welcome to Book World.
Thank you.
This show has a special way of wanting to care, at least, about writers whose formative experiences were in some way Californian. You were raised in Palo Alto, and you stayed here.
Well, I think my I was about 3 and a half when my parents moved to Palo Alto. Excuse me for coughing. I have laryngitis after 3 weeks of talking. And stayed, basically grew up there, and my family's still there.
It's kind of an interesting thing because California has more and more, after being a place where writers like Jack London came from, a place where people expected writers who were writing about foreign experience, London's in Africa, in Alaska, or Steinbeck's On the Road with Farmers and the Migrants. We're now discovering a Californian kind of writer, like Amy Hampel, for instance, or yourself, or Betty Nellis, who are bringing back, in some sense, do you think, a sensibility that may have been very much formed out here?
Well, I certainly think all writers are drawn back to the place where they grew up. And I'm not sure if I would call it a sensibility as simply a world. You know, Faulkner had his Yakna Potawatomi County, and for me, I have my sort of Bay Area with its computer companies and funny little health food shops and people who with very distant German accents who seem to be refugees from someplace very, very, very far east. And to me, it's home turf. It's where I always find myself drawn back to. Because it's the essential landscape of my writing, even if I don't live there. In a sense, I think I have to live somewhere else in order to write about it, but it's my literary homeland. And I think maybe because it's such an interesting and unusual place, I'd say particularly Northern California seems to have been creating a lot of writers lately, or at least a lot of writers who are very devoted to recreating that part of the world as a literary homeland.
Would you say that there's any kind of emotional connection with the geographical space? It seems to me, at any rate, that in some of your work, there's an emotional laissez-faire of parents doing their own particular projects and children following what this coast has chosen to call lifestyles that may be all of their own, and that the family becomes a central place for these different pursuits, not exactly to influence one another, but simply to convene.
Well, in Equal Affections, I think the father thinks of California as a freer, less rule-bound world, as a place where you can go and escape some of the strictures of the East, perhaps particularly of New England. And I think in that book as well, that's the inheritance of the children who certainly choose to pursue lives very very far from what their parents ever imagined for them, and in that way are very different from the way their parents were as children, since Louise as a child has inherited such a strong sense of propriety, a sense of propriety so strong that she's in a sense shaped her whole life according to what she thinks is proper rather than according to what she wants.
I had a friend who told me that her first novel was Snoozy in Paris, which was about her dog. At what point did you start writing? just a joke. I was talking to a friend who was telling me when writing became serious for her, and she said, I think it was with Snoozy in Paris.
When did I start writing? I started writing as soon as I started reading, but I started writing fiction seriously when I was in college, when I more or less left California for the first time and was able to begin to find my own identity outside my family, outside my growing up, and therefore to sort of reassess the experience of my growing up in a way that might turn it into fiction.
Were there particular writers or groups of writers where you first put down the book and said, ah, this is what I'd like to be like, these are the kinds of thoughts I'd like to be able to have?
I felt that all the time. I felt that the first time I read Grace Paley, the first time I read Alice Munro, and then on a sort of other level, the first time I read Jane Austen, the first time I read George Eliot, maybe most strongly when I read Middlemarch. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've ever felt it so strongly with another book.
And what about poetry?
I wrote a lot of poetry. I went through a very intense T.S. Eliot period, which was subsequently eclipsed by a very intense Wallace Stevens period, which was subsequently eclipsed by a very intense W.H. Auden period. And in each case, I spurned whoever I'd been reading before in favor of the one I was reading then as the great poet. Now I've come to appreciate all three of them. I think I'm a little more even-handed in my old age.
Simultaneously.
Well, I think they're all great poets.
They are all great poets. It's interesting because I did notice when I was growing up on the East Coast where so much poetry was happening around me at St. Mark's Place. Mm-hmm. We're roughly coevals. And so, you know, Ginsberg came to prominence roughly within my own consciousness. Mm-hmm. And there was constantly a sense of poetry, contemporary poetry, parading past and eclipsing one's sense or attempting to eclipse one's sense of the classic modern poetry. In San Francisco, another poetry center, there is also that sense of that parade. Were you influenced by any of the movements that were happening around there as you grew up?
Well, I certainly read a lot of poetry when I was growing up, but I'm not sure I'd say I was influenced by it because at that point I thought I wanted to write poetry. So it certainly had a lot of influence on the kind of poetry I wrote, but I subsequently gave up poetry. I was not a very good poet. And I don't know how much of that contemporary poetry has really had an effect on my fiction.
Equal Affections by David Levitt has just come out from Weidenfeld and Nicholson, and it is preceded by an epigraph from W.H. Auden. In fact, when I found the epigraph and went back to look up the poem, I found myself repeating it almost like a mantra in situations of difficulty. The epigraph is, "If equal affection cannot be, let the more loving one be me." I found myself in ways that I don't like to confess, you know, kind of walking away burning from a situation and saying, "Let the more loving one be me." When I went and checked the poem, it's in the midst of a poem almost about cosmic indifference.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
While the two lines quoted are lines of great emotional attachment. Mm-hmm. The book seems to waver, not waver exactly, but satellite spin between the poles of affection and indifference, almost as if the epigraph were a signal leading you back to the original poem where you might find the opposite pole, the indifferent pole. To what extent are those human capacities of affection and indifference at the center of this book?
Well, I think you found the center of the book. I'm not sure I would say indifference, but certainly this is a book about the need for intimacy and the fear of intimacy, and about the ways in which the choices that all these characters make, the choices which determine their lives, are determined by this intense need for human intimacy. To me, that's a great mystery. Why do we need other people? Who knows? But we do. Except, of course, there's a part of the book which is about a sort of almost technological experiment in living without intimacy and attempting to have human communication, even sex, without intimacy. And that, to me, serves as a kind of counterpoint to the almost excessive, suffocating intimacy of this family. It's ironic to call a book Equal Affections when the book is entirely about the inequity of affections, the inequity of human relationships. And yet, in a sense, I think what the book finally advocates is the importance of taking the risk of being a lover rather than merely the passive object of love. The ironic twist when you put the poem back into the context of Auden, when you put the line back into the context of Auden's poem, in which it becomes ironic response is sort of almost a cosmic rape. I mean, the line which comes before is something like, what if the stars were to burn with a passion for us we could not return? If equal affection cannot be, let the more loving one be me. Which in a sense sounds like, you know, it would be too much to have to deal with that kind of intense love. Well, that is sort of the other side of the coin in this book as well.
And eventually in the poem, the recognition that the stars don't care, nor does the man, as he comes to realize, care all that much. If the stars were to disappear, he would find the sky's emptiness sublime too. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's why I found myself feeling, how to put it, and we started a conversation before the interview at a bit at tenterhooks, or felt a log jam there, but we may be talking about the same thing. Between the pole of intense caring, or in spiritual terms, that would be something like spiritual mania or affirmation of faith, and intense indifference, feeling that there's an unconnected circuit, you know, that if there is a God, he's not choosing to make himself known or to comment. I found that as I went through the book, there's a kind of sine wave between enormous sympathy and enormous distance in the charting of the trajectory of a woman's illness, Louise, the mother of the Cooper family in the book, and her relations with the people around her, which at times are very connected to her, at times very disparate. I found myself thinking as this book went on, and this may just be a kind of Jewishness, or a grandmother saying, if there is a God, we'll have lamb chops for dinner, and there would be lamb chops. I would find myself feeling, if there is a God, this novel will make this woman well. That if there were somehow a kind writer at its heart, the need to go all the way through the experience of a cancer that ends up being like or akin to a skin burn would not have to be charted all the way. You responded that you did not feel like a god at all as a novelist, but a charter of a path already set. What goes on there? A woman dies in this book, and you have had to sit by writing it with enormous care. What is the writing of that like?
Well, it was intense and painful and difficult, but I had to get it down. It seemed to me the heart of the whole book. What happens when you lose someone who is the very center of your life, and especially when you lose that person in a violent and painful way? As I think I said earlier, a lot of this book has to do with the fear of intimacy. People are afraid of intimacy these days because they're afraid of losing themselves or losing each other. Intimacy is dangerous. It gives you diseases. Intimacy is also dangerous because it means you get close to someone and then that person's gone and then you're hurt. Isn't it easier just to live a life without intimacy? Well, perhaps, but you may lead a riskless life. You also lead a rewardless life. I think in order to illustrate that properly, in order to fully articulate that whole range of ideas, I had to show people going through loss. It also makes me think of another I mean, what you were saying about the indifference, that if there were a God, it would have saved, a God would have saved this woman, makes me think of a line from Stevens, from Notes Toward a Supreme Fiction, where he says, "From this poem springs that we live in a place not our own, and much more not ourselves, and hard it is in spite of blazing days."
The responses to the book, it's interesting, have presumed, I think, a kind of intimacy with the writer that may be unfortunate. I personally was astonished to see in Vanity Fair James Wolcott identifying the narrator of the book so entirely with the character, and moving from personal statements that you've made in interviews to a life inside the book which he identifies as yours.
Well, James Wolcott is not known to be a terribly ethical man.
Known or not known, the question really is about the sense of intimacy that writing brings to readers that lets them assume that they can make certain judgments.
I don't think it does. I think this has much more to do with James Wolcott's presumptuousness than with anything else.
How did you respond?
I'm not responding. I'm responding by ignoring. I don't think that piece dignifies a response.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you. Equal affections in charting the life of a family charts the lives, too, of the children, who are both of them to different degrees of commitment or in different ways of commitment gay. The book is not about gayness, but could not have been the book it is if the children weren't gay. To what extent does that influence this book as opposed to the previous one?
Well, I think you said it exactly right. They are gay. That's essential to the experience of the family, the experience of the book, but it's not what the book's about. I've never understood why a character can't just be gay in a book and have that be relevant and specific without being the book's center. I think it's because we assume that if characters belong to any minority, that minority status has to be what the book's about. If you have a black character in a book, well, then it has to be a novel about the experience of being black. If you have a Jewish character, then it has to be a Jewish novel. We live in a very in a culture which is dominated by the idea that the normative experience is the experience of a straight white WASP man, which is why no one ever describes John Updike's novels as straight novels or complains about the fact that his characters are all straight, or at least the majority of them. So for me, I write from a very naive place where I'm not aware of all these presumptions. And so to me, it's as natural to put gay characters in a book as it is for John Updike to put straight characters in a book.
I want to thank David Levitt, who's here with a book tour and who's read About Town at the Unicorn Bookstore at A Different Light and elsewhere. I want to thank him for a really luminous book in which finally the experience of floating within emotions that both overwhelm and at the same time need to be distanced vie for the attention of the characters. It was almost an experience in reading like learning to move in close and move away at the same time. A very odd experience and a very moving one. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
This is Michael Silverblatt with Bookworm. After I interviewed David Levitt, I decided to call his editor, John Herman, at Weidenfeld & Nicholson in New York to see if I could learn more about the editing process. Are you there, John?
Yes, I am.
Oh, terrific. I agree. I believe that this is the first book you've done with David Levitt. Is that so?
That's the case.
What was the process of editing Equal Affection like?
Do you mean, how did it run? What did we do?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, the manuscript went through a number of different versions, and David would hand in to me sections of it, and I'd read it, and we'd talk about it. didn't fit in to the overall harmony of the work and detracted from the power of the work as a whole, so we decided to remove some of those. And then there was some, when we had a complete manuscript that we felt was in the shape that we pretty much wanted, there was some fine tuning of language here and there.
It's wonderful to know that you're having the classic relation with a writer that one thinks of from Maxwell Perkins' days, but one hears is very infrequent nowadays in publishing. Does that tend to be the policy over at Weidenfeld and Nicholson?
Very definitely the case. I mean, we definitely are hands-on editors who work closely with our writers and try to give them whatever assistance and support we can.
Weidenfeld and Nicholson is a relatively new publishing house. How long have you been in existence?
Oh, about 3.5 years now.
Which is very young for a major publishing house. What do you as an editor look for in a first novel that you're taking a look at to see if perhaps you'd be interested in the writer?
Well, it's a combination of things. An editor ultimately needs to buy his own taste. He needs to respond to the writing and feel that it's outstanding in some manner and that you enjoy it. You need to have some sense over your shoulder of the audience that there are other people who are going to share your enthusiasm for the work. So it's some combination of those two things or of those that congeries of things. But ultimately, it's a sense of what you think you as a reader and therefore others as readers will respond to.
Weidenfeld and Nicholson is now publishing some of the writers that I find to be very interesting, Frederick Barthelme's books. Harry Matthews, I think, also is from Weidenfeld and Nicholson. Who are some of the other writers you work with?
Well, I work with Robert Stone, and I work with, as you say, Rick Barthelme, John Hawkes, Aaron Appelfeld, Hortense Kalischer.
Oh my! You must be a very happy man. I didn't know you worked with Hawks, who's
indeed
a real favorite of mine.
Yeah.
And I'm an admirer of his recent book, Whistle Jacket, particularly its middle section. And what does Robert Stone have coming up?
He's working on a new novel, which we hope will be publishing in about a year.
Oh, terrific! Is there a book of stories too? He's had such wonderful stories recently and essays that have been appearing in magazines around the country.
Indeed. Well, we've discussed that, but as yet, that's still up in the air. But as you say, he's written a number of wonderful stories, and that's a good idea.
When you took Equal Affection, were you concerned a bit? I'd ask David. You know, I'm a reader who wants, to some extent, magic from books where it won't inhere in life, and so I prayed that there was some way to save the mother from dying in Equal Affection. Was there a level at which the unhappiness in the novel concerned you, both either aesthetically or, you know, economically?
Well, one of the things that I responded to was David's emotional honesty in dealing with a topic that's as sensitive and as painful as the death of a mother. But I do think the book also has many themes and images of rebirth in it, and it goes beyond the death of the mother to the family is continuing in its various ways beyond her death. So I think it's a book not only about the death of a central matriarchal figure, but also about how a family copes with that and goes on.
I'm sure that many of my listeners, you know, here on the West Coast, people rarely meet editors at cocktail parties. When I grew up in New York, there was hardly a party that didn't have an editor. Strange animals here in Los Angeles, though. Can you tell me, what kind of person is an editor? What's your background?
My background, not perhaps surprisingly, is academics. I've come out of teaching and went into editing because that seemed to be a good profession for somebody who cares about books and makes that the center of his life.
It must be, especially, I guess, as an ex-academic, particularly gratifying to work with writers like Levitt, Hawks, Barthelme, Kalischer, et al. It seems like, when I said that you're a lucky man, it seems like you're in a kind of dream position.
Well, that's nice to hear. And authors is indeed a great privilege and tremendously exciting and stimulating.
Have you had cases where you've requested changes that have really gone against the grain of an author's sensibility that you've stood by and insisted on?
Truthfully, I can't think of that. Certainly with the kinds of writers that we're talking about now, the caliber and level that you're talking about, a good editor is there to make suggestions and even to press his or her suggestions. But ultimately, it's very much the writer's book, and you've got to defer to their judgment. I suppose there could come a point where you would feel that the book was so out of hand that you didn't want to publish it, but I've certainly never been there myself.
To what extent do you regard yourself then as a midwife assisting a difficult delivery?
Well, I'm not sure I'm entirely happy with that image, but it's not inapt. A good editor, to follow what you're saying, serves both, and here I take a deep breath, but serves both the mother and the child, and they're not entirely the same thing, certainly not in parturation, nor even with the author. Sometimes a book takes a shape that's surprising both to the writer as well as to the editor, and sometimes the editor spies it before the writer.
Well, finally, if you were to recommend two or three books that are coming out from Weidenfeld and Nicholson this coming season, perhaps books that the audience may not yet know the authors of as yet, what would you be recommending right now?
Well, that's a challenging and interesting question. And it's a little bit like asking me to pick amongst my children, so I'm somewhat hesitant to do it. But so perhaps I'll just say that we are publishing an immense number, not immense, but a goodly number of interesting and challenging writers. A new writer like Nicholson Baker, whose book The Mezzanine got tremendous...
Oh, it was terrific. Yeah. I really liked it.
Yeah. And I'm publishing another book by Aaron Appelfeld soon. A nonfiction book by John Lucas. I did his book on Budapest, 1900. Mm-hmm. A collection of essays I've just published by John Simon, which are tremendously stimulating and interesting. But as I said, it's hard for me to pick among my books, and if I begin, I don't know where I'll end. I'll just end up boring you and your listeners. But I do urge you, if I may get a little lick in here, to look in your bookstores for Weidenfeld books, because I think you'll find them interesting.
Well, thank you very much, John Herman of Weidenfeld & Nicholson in New York. This is Michael Silverblatt. I'd like to thank my engineer, Rob Carlson, and my producer, Judy Cash. This is Good Afternoon from Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, books, books.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse, mouse time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.